So Kate and I enjoy keeping you up to date on what we're doing with our simply wonderful confirmation class, 33 ninth graders. It's been a wonderful year. We've shared a little bit already. We've gone through the topics of Jesus and the Bible and the Holy Spirit and God and mission and the church. And we try to make it interesting, you know, do fun things, not always serious. And so, but we never, I don't think we've ever really given any tests. But recently we did ask them some questions about the Bible. And so we thought we'd ask you some questions about the Bible to test your knowledge. You ready? No? So, let's begin with Noah. Why didn't Noah go fishing? Because they only had two worms. Why was there no card playing on the ark? Because Noah was standing on the deck. More? Yeah. How do we know that Peter was a rich fisherman? How do we know that Peter was a rich fisherman? By his net income.
Paul.
You calling
turn it? Turn off his mic.
A couple more. Who was the greatest financier of the Bible? Financier of the Bible. Noah, because as everyone else was in liquidation, he was floating his stock. What did Eve and Adam ever go out on a date? No, because they had an apple. Way to go, Susie. Okay, only two more. How did Moses make coffee? He brews it. He brews it. Okay. Final two, the sports one. I think I did do the sports ones with the confirmation class. You know that tennis is in the Bible? Aaron served in Pharaoh's court. And finally, which gets us into the topic of today, a long winding way to today, where is baseball mentioned in the Bible? Genesis chapter 1, in the big inning, good job. So, what we did with our, then after those corny jokes with the confirmation class, we had our confirmation class go to the beginning of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, that full page is chapter 1. We don't have time, but if you were the confirmation class, I'd have you all turn to it. And by yourself, read through the first chapter, and as you read through it, I'd ask you, what Kate and I asked you to do is count the number of times the word good occurs, the word good. But we don't have enough time, so Nancy is just going to read selections of chapter 1 of Genesis, the creation story, and you get to count to yourself how many times the word good.
I better do good. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. And God said, "Let the waters under the sky be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." Then God said, "Let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees of every kind on earth that bear fruit with the seed in it." And it was so, and God saw that it was good. And God said, Let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them be lights in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth. And God saw that it was good. So God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, of every kind, with which the waters swarm, and every winged bird of every kind. And God saw that it was good. God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind, and the cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground of every kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." God saw everything that he had made, and indeed, it was very good.
Thank you, Nancy. How many times?
Six.
You may or may not know this about Genesis and the creation story. There actually are two different versions of the creation story in Genesis, and they're actually pretty different. In the version that we've just heard, do you think the author was trying to give a precise scientific description of how the world was created? No, not really. What was the author trying to convey to us? That it's good. Creation is very, very good. May God bless our understanding of this reading.
Thanks be to God.
On December 24th, 1968, in what was then the most watched television broadcast, as the crew of the Apollo 8 orbited the moon, what did Bill Anders, Jim Lovell, and Frank Borman read? Well, after Anders and Lovell had each read from the first chapter of the book of Genesis, the world then heard the voice of Frank Borman.
"God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called these seas. But God saw that it was good. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth."
God saw that it was good, our good earth. Since the beginning of creation, or at least since the beginning when two-legged creatures walked on the face of this earth, people of faith, poets, philosophers, scientists, photographers, astronauts, have all stood in awe of God's truly magnificent, beautiful, and yet sometimes mysterious creation. And yet, as we all go through our busy days at work, at school, running to and fro, we know that it is not always easy to appreciate the beauty that is all around us. John O'Donohue, an Irish poet, priest, and philosopher, was also involved in environmental activism. In 2008, he died suddenly at the age of 52, but his words live on, and he exhorts all of us to stand in awe of God's created beauty. He wrote, "When we approach with reverence, great things decide to approach us. Our real life comes to the surface, and its light awakens the concealed beauty in things. When we walk on the earth with reverence, beauty will decide to trust us. The rushed heart and arrogant mind lack the gentleness and the patience to enter that embrace." The rushed heart and the arrogant mind lack the gentleness and patience to enter that embrace. Perhaps no one has ever articulated this sentiment better than the poet Mary Oliver. Her poem, Praying, captures O'Donohue's sentiment that we need a gentleness and a patience to enter into the embrace of God's beautiful creation. It doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be weeds in a vacant lot or a few small stones. Just pay attention, then patch a few words together, and don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but the doorway into thanks and a silence in which another voice may speak. Well, if Mary Oliver patches together a few words with her amazing poetry, I have tried as a complete amateur to just pay attention with the help of a very forgiving digital camera and capture the beauty of creation that is simply all around us each and every day. All of the pictures of creation that you will see this morning, except for that one from the moon, I took with either just a very simple camera, no fancy lens or much skill, or even simply my iPhone. And I show them not because I'm a good photographer, rather I show them because God is an amazing creator. God gives any budding photographer or poet some truly extraordinary work, material to work with. With Kate as my witness, the original intent of this sermon was simply to allow us to luxuriate in the beauty of God's creation. My original intent was just to let us all stand in the doorway of thanks. But as it often does, the real world in which we live has a way of inserting itself. And so this past Monday morning, my week began, as it usually does, with a couple of double espressos at home, Connecticut Public Radio in the background, The Current and The Times on the counter. The morning edition host on Connecticut Public Radio, Steve Inskeep, was interviewing Mustafa Ali, who resigned last week as the founding director of the Environmental Justice Office of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Inskeep asks Ali, for those who haven't really heard of it, what is environmental justice? And Ali responds, environmental justice deals with the disproportionate impacts that are happening in low-income communities, communities of color, and tribal populations. Then it all came back to me. It was 30 years ago, next month, that the United Church of Christ played a seminal role in establishing our nation's commitment to environmental justice. You see, on April 16th, 1987, Benjamin Chavis and Charles Lee, with whom I worked with at the national headquarters in New York City for the UCC, released the groundbreaking study which documented that in this country there has been a racial bias in where we dump our toxic waste. The New York Times article covering that news conference in 1987 read, communities with large concentrations of Black and Hispanic people have more hazardous waste facilities than other populated areas, a study released today concluded. The study, prepared by the United Church of Christ Commission for Racial Justice, asserted that the possibility that the placement of these dumps resulted by chance was virtually impossible. Then on Thursday of this past week, as I once again dipped into my double espressos, I looked at the front page of the New York Times. Perhaps some of you saw it. Grim fate for a natural wonder. Scientists say huge sections of the Great Barrier Reef, a coral ecosystem off the coast of Australia, so large it can be seen from space, are dead or dying because of rising sea temperatures. And then if you go up to the top of the New York Times, sharp cuts for EPA. Let's just hope and pray that all of our elected officials will do their very best to preserve and protect our God-given creation. Just a few more thoughts before I conclude. Thoughts of folk far wiser than I on the matter of preserving what Frank Borman called this good earth. First, this sermon was actually originally planned for last fall, because in 2016, our nation celebrated the 100th anniversary of the establishment of our national park system. Henry David Thoreau said, "In wildness is the preservation of the world." And in April of 1903, Teddy Roosevelt, who has been called the conservation president, said the following: "Every man who appreciates the majesty and beauty of the wilderness and of wildlife should strike hands with the far-sighted men who wish to preserve our material resources. It is entirely within our power as a nation to preserve large tracts of wilderness, but this end can only be achieved by wise laws and a resolute enforcement of the laws." Now some thoughts about trees. I don't know about you, but trees have played an important part in my life, maybe in yours as well. At my house growing up in Worcester, Massachusetts, in the front yard there was an enormous beech tree, not unlike the tree in front of the Wells Turner Library. Great tree for climbing. And then we also had another great tree for climbing, a fairly large Japanese red maple that Dorothy and I used to love to climb in. And not far from that red maple was an enormous birch tree. They often don't get big, but the trunk of the three of them were about that big, had survived windstorms and ice. Well, Mary Oliver's poem, "When I Am Among Trees," is, I think, the definitive word about trees. "When I am among the trees, especially the willows and the honey locust, equally the beech, the oaks, and the pines, they give off such hints of gladness. I would almost say that they save me, and daily. I am so distant from the hope of myself, in which I have goodness and discernment, and never hurry through the world, but walk slowly, and bow often. Around me the trees stir in their leaves and call out, 'Stay a while.' The light flows from their branches, and they call again. 'It's simple,' they say, 'and you too have come into the world to do this, to go easy, to be filled with light, and to shine.'" And I conclude with words from Wendell Berry. Perhaps you've heard of him, a great 82-year-old Kentucky farmer, novelist, poet. His words about God's creation are inspiring, but also they are a warning that we must love and revere this good earth. He writes, "But even more important, we must learn to acknowledge that the creation is full of mystery. We will never entirely understand it. We must abandon arrogance and stand in awe. We must recover the sense of the majesty of creation and the ability to be worshipful in its presence. For I do not doubt that it is only on the condition of humility and reverence before the world that our species will be able to remain in it." And so, friends, as we day by day recover our sense of the majesty of this creation and be worshipful in its presence, may we always approach God's good earth with humility and with reverence, And may we always stand before God's creation with awe. Amen.